Hello and welcome to another episode of Sounds Like Comics, the podcast devoted to all things comic books in movies and TV. I'm Luke.
And I'm Jay. Welcome to the podcast.
Today's topic, Star Trek Generations, the seventh film in the Star Trek film series. Malcolm McDowell joins cast members from the 1960s television show Star Trek and the 1987 sequel series The Next Generation, including William Shatner and Patrick Stewart. This is your warning. We will be talking spoilers.
Yeah, the first of the generation, next gen cast of films. They didn't even disassemble the sets from the show because not that long ago, Patrick Stewart released his memoirs, Making It So, I think that they were called. It's on my bookshelf back here.
Make It So.
Talking about how they had like a rap part in it. Like there was no like, oh, I can't believe after 7 years that we're breaking up. It was all right. Enjoy your summer. See you back here to start recording the film. Yep. Sweet. Great. It was that like, but rapid. In fact, I think they literally just had their normal, even a truncated time off than they would have had normally at the end of a season, because they went straight into filming this work, which works well because they don't need to rebuild the sets and like, oh, colors the carpets. Oh, we can't get the carpet anymore. We need to change it.
And that's it. They still had it. It's a weird one because of course in the '60s, we got the original series, three seasons. It came back as an animated series for a while, and then we had to wait until Star Trek the Motion Picture. So before our time, it had already made the transition from being a TV show to a film series. So we've always known it to be that way, but there's not many examples, really, where you can think of something starting as a TV show and then continuing as a successful film series. But you still see Generations as a film. The sets, you know, there is differences, but they had to make some differences, tweaks, you know, to make, because what looks good on a TV at home isn't going to look as good at the cinema. So they did need to spend some more money in different areas. But
yeah, well, because one of the major ones,
but it was still like putting TV on the big screen. Like this movie, the budget, right? $35 million. Go and make a Star Trek film today for $35 million.
You couldn't, that wouldn't pay for the sets, never mind about anything else. And that's the thing, because at the time, the weekly show was filmed for television in, 16:9 format. And then they had to film it in widescreen. And that massively alters how you have to compose your shots and everything else, because they hadn't thought how to think of that before, because suddenly the camera is capturing more than is going to be presented. Like, oh, we didn't have to worry about that panel over there being a bit dicky because we always had them walk in and go this way, and it was never in shot. Well, now that shot's 20-30% larger because it's wider. And it shows up in shot. You gotta do something with that. You gotta bring it up to the rest of the standards. Also, I believe this was the last Star Trek film in which they used Star Trek anything, where they used practical models. Voyager was already being filmed, and that was a fully CGI model. They weren't using a shooting model.
It's really DS9 noticeable.
Had transitioned.
It's noticeable in this when ships are exploding, when the enemy's ships are exploding, like, that's a model. But you know what? I love it.
Fun fact about that shot, they didn't blow that model up for this film. That is the exact same model shot from Star Trek III, The Return of Spock.
No way.
And Star Trek Six, The Undiscovered Country. They use it multiple times in The Next Gen when they blew up Birds of Prey, and they use it again here.
I mean, how many different ways? It is
the most recycled shot in Star Trek film, not TV, because they use those establishing shots over and over every single week.
How many different ways? You don't
notice when there's a week.
Can you blow up a Klingon bird of prey? I think they did it that one time. Like, do you know what? I think we've got it.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
cannot be improved upon.
I was just going to say, right, I like it, and it's just because it's like a throwback to how they would have used models, like not like what they're doing with like modern Trek on TV now, but what you're telling me, it's what they shot years prior, and they've just been repurposing it. Oh, but you know what? I still like it.
Same.
That's
one of those
35 million. It's like they need to.
Squeeze every penny.
They need to do it somehow.
Yeah, especially like Star Trek's famous for doing stuff like that. Like they do slightly change up the coloring on the fire and things like that, and like to recompose the shot. And in context, again, if you didn't know, it's like scenes, like the LA Observatory is on like God knows how many different movies and stuff. It's the same location. They never bother to dress it up as anything else. But like the high school in Buffy the Vampire Slayer is also the high school from Not Another Teen Movie, which is also the high school from like 90210, which is also the high school from 21 Jump Street. And it goes on and on. Like they always film in the same place.
They do.
Just known. And Star Trek is like the kings of that. It's like, we're not even going to refilm it. We're just going to reuse the old footage. Like,
going to reuse it.
For those who don't know, those studio filming models, and the reason that we don't use them these days is they're actually exceptionally expensive. They have to be taken care of. They're restrictive in the shots you can get from them because you have to mount them to get your motion capture and all that sort of stuff. It reduces your speed and the dynamic kind of shots you can get and all that stuff. Those models themselves, I think they run like a couple hundred thousand each. So if you've already blown up one of these studio models in a previous like outing and it's the exact same model ship, you really want to blow up another $100,000 model for a similar shot. Like, can you make that other one work? Yeah, we'll make it work. We'll just reframe it. Yeah, cool. Sweet. Great. Oh, we'll have CGI ILM put a little something in the foreground so people don't notice. Again, if you don't put them back, it's when you put them back to back. There are compilations online. We can see on YouTube people have done this, how all the different spaces they've used that shot, which includes episodes of the series. But yeah, it is like one of those little things that Star Trek nerds like myself love.
Notice, yeah.
But like I said, 35 million, that is.
And you get to share with me. Yeah, it's really impressive. Like, I thought it was a typo at first when I was doing my notes, but no, it was a budget of 35 million.
Costumes taken from DS9.
We'll get to the costumes. All of a sudden we want to talk fashion whenever we're talking Star Trek. We will get there. All right. Generations was conceived as a transition from the original cast of the Star Trek films to the cast of the Next Generation. After developing several film ideas concurrently, the producers chose a script written by Ronald D. Moore and Brannon Braga. Production began while the final season of the TV series was being made. So there you go. The director was David Carson, who previously directed episodes of the TV series. And when I looked into it, like, where did this guy, in his English, where did he get his start in television? Coronation Street.
Of course.
The famous British
No doubt in my mind.
He pretty much went from Coronation Street to Star Trek. He went to the United States. He met with producer Rick Berman and David Livingston and was hired to direct the episode The Enemy of Next Gen. Producers liked the different British style of directing and scene blocking that Carson brought to the set, as it was a style that the show hadn't previously used. He was approached by Rick Berman to direct the opening episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Emissary. So this guy started Coronation Street, and then just went on to do so much Star Trek. His final work for Star Trek was this film.
Yeah. Which I think it performed below expectations, but it was moving to the next gen cast, which annoyed some Trekkies, like having the original series cast in the movies and having them on TV was like a bridge initially of like, oh, at least we still get our Star Trek on the big screen. And to hell with those new guys. But this is the first time that they had to confront, like, our guys are gone. I'm like, they aged out, essentially. Like,
they did, but
still expect them at that age to be having those kinds of adventures.
Yeah.
It like everyone, you have to put draw a line somewhere. Like they would have been either retired or just promoted out of active service and like to running areas like Scotty, like someone of that intelligence. Come on now.
I think they did a really good job. And then, you know, when Kirk, believed dead, is in the Nexus, what is that, 78 years or 70? Yeah, okay, so 78 years. That was a clever way of having Kirk and Picard meet. But we can get to all that. You're talking about, you know, so the opening, right? Number one at the US box office. So it did open at number one, but you're going to get a lot of Star Trek fans going in there. And then, yeah, grossed 118 million worldwide. But critical reception was mixed, with critics divided on the film's characters and then whether or not the casual viewers would understand or care about what was going on with the older guys, the TV cast. Because, again, like, we know it so much as like Star Trek on the big screen and on the small screen. But if you're watching Next Gen one week, and then you're having to go to the movies. In fact, do you know what? They're doing it with that movie, The Mandalorian and Grogu. You've been watching Mandalorian on Disney Plus, but now Disney are going to be like, hey, if you want to see the movie, you need to go and buy a ticket at the movies.
Yeah, I think Disney are going to learn what Paramount learned in the 90s of, no, that I've been getting this at home. I am not giving you money to go see what I've been getting at home. Not for free, because it's a streaming service, so you do pay for it. But essentially, I only paid $13, and me and my whole family got to watch it. Now you want me to give you $13 a pop? No.
It's going to be interesting to see them do that. You know, we talked off air. We've got some gaps in our Star Trek film coverage. We've done Star Trek 1 through 4. We need to do 5, 6. So we've jumped, but we will go back. And I'm like, hey, let's do Generations in good timing, because it is the 30th anniversary. That is crazy to me. Yeah. I remember when this film was new. 30th anniversary, the next movie, First Contact, which we will be getting to shortly, that doesn't feel like an episode of the TV series. That does feel like a big, you know, theatrical release.
And this has always been a massive issue with any Star Trek film. It's either just an expanded episode of the show, which for Star Trek people is great. Like, yeah, more of what I love. Why are you annoyed? What is wrong with you? Or they alter it up to be more action orientated and more of a big screen feel, and it feels less Star Trek-y. It's very hard for them to thread that needle. Everyone always talks Wrath of Khan. They talk about the one with the whales.
Love that one.
Which we have covered.
But Wrath of Khan was a sequel to an episode of the original series. And First Contact is connected to an episode of Next Gen. So it's interesting how favorites are connected to
it. Yeah, I was going to say, like, First Contact is one of those ones that people talk about of, like, building what feels naturally out of the lore is always like a caveat. Like, whenever you alter it up, it doesn't work for some Star Trek fans. The J.J. Abrams films, people feel like, oh, that's too Star Trek-y. That's too Star Wars-y. It is not Star Trek, even though I think they're great. And I think that cast did an amazing job. And I'm still annoyed that we haven't had a fourth film from them all, which looks apparently, like it may never come at this point.
Well, every now and then they say that it's still coming. First JJ movie in particular is fantastic. We'll get to that one day as well. You know what? Yeah. Eventually, we would have reviewed all of Star Trek. We're doing a good job. Yeah. We're working our way through all of it.
Yeah.
Let's start with the next gen cast. We'll get to the original series actors, but reprising their roles, we have Patrick Stewart as Captain Jean-Luc Picard. This is the first time I've watched it since Picard, the TV series, has ended. Because my takeaway when I was first watching the TV series Picard is that, wow, it's so much focused on his family, not having kids of his own, and then, you know, the events of the TV series happen. But then watching Generations now, it's like, that is like a whole thing, like the baggage that Jean-Luc is carrying around with him. Whereas my memory of Star Trek wasn't him as a person and his family. It was always the missions that they were going on. But
yeah,
that's what we've got a lot of in the TV series, Picard. But no, it's all here in this movie.
Yeah, and that they did an amazing job. I maybe at my age, it hits better now. I appreciate the new ones, having watched the episodes so many times over, and Patrick Stewart and other stuff. But specifically the stuff which... You have your original opening, which is, you know, like with the original cast and the launch of the Enterprise B. Then you jump forward to the next gen cast, and they're on the holodeck doing the little ritual for Worf to get his promotion. And Picard's genuinely happy, and he's enjoying being on the boat and like fantasizing about like, oh, this was living, Will. And then he gets a message, and immediately there's a change. And we are like, what's that about? And we see Counselor Troy look, and like, something's not right. And then he's off. And then for the first act of the movie, he's off his game massively.
He really is.
And we know something's wrong. He's dismissive. He's not paying attention. He's not doing his job. And it's really greatly written and expertly performed by everyone.
Everyone.
By Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Frakes' reaction. Like, he's like, this is not my captain. I've told you what's going on. Why? It's not my job to handle it. Me contact Starfleet. That's your job. Why are you palming this off onto me? And then when you finally get the reveal, when Counselor Troy goes to him and he's in quiet and just going through his photos, and she just does it perfectly, like, oh, can I help you with something? So I was coming here to ask you that. And she just sits quiet. He just invites her to sit down, and she just sits and listens. And you're watching him like speak about what is actually happening. And then it's just like, matter of factly, there was a fire, and you're like, oh, Jesus, good Lord. And then he's trying to be strong. He breaks. He then tries to pack it all back up and go back into captain mode. And she's like, this is serious. Like, this means something to you. Like, this is like, you can't just file this away. And it becomes a great theme at the back half of the movie with him and the Nexus. It really frames, and it works for me so much better this rewatch than any of my previous ones. But man, it's everyone's performance around it is phenomenal. And thankfully, for such heavy source material, you are in your B story lighting the mood with Data and LaForge, and him putting in his emotion chip, and Brent Spiner getting to be silly, which he loves hamming it up, but it has reason. It has purpose.
But
and he's having to run a gamut.
Yeah, but we're getting comedic relief from Data.
Yep.
But then there's everything that he's going through, like with the emotions that he's feeling, yeah. and it's malfunctioning. It needs to deactivate it. It's like, no, it's working. Like, you're experiencing things. Honestly, we're talking about how this movie went into production during the final season of Next Gen. We're experiencing it watching the movie. You've got to think, Patrick Stewart, the rest of the cast, they're reading this script. It's like, oh, this is not what we've been doing on a weekly basis. There's a lot.
Yeah, this is ramifications.
That's it. You know, we're not having like all the guest stars hidden under all these prosthetics. Like, everyone's humanoid. It's a different kind of thing. So yeah, like, great material that Patrick Stewart's got to work with here. Jonathan Frakes, him and Patrick Stewart, their chemistry. That's what worked so well in Picard in that first season when Riker comes back. And then, of course, in season three, and when they were butting heads, it was like fantastic. I just love their relationship. And I love how Patrick Stewart says, Will, just how familiar they are. But LeVar Burton back as Chief Engineer, Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge, this movie, it's the last time that you get to see him wearing his trademark visor. I've seen this movie so many times, but then when First Contact happens and he's got those new ocular lenses, I always just thought that it's just an upgrade. Just like they've got the Enterprise E, it's just an upgrade that he's got just because it looks newer. Yeah. Well, his visor got compromised in this movie. Of course
he
couldn't use it. But you know, at the beginning when they're on the boat?
Yeah.
And he puts the telescope up to his visor, but he puts it in the middle. I was like, is that how it would work? Is that how his visor works? Like, I was thinking, obviously, it's not
essentially
using his two eyes. See, it's just, I don't know.
That takes some acting, because surely, like, because you can see every now and then when he's acting, especially when he gives like an eyebrow raise. Like, but yeah, it's really hard to remember that the character itself is blind, and it's what he takes from the visor, not what he takes from his eyes. His visor is just interpreting the what around him, and it sees in like narrower but also wider perspectives in terms of like frequencies and everything. But putting it up to his middle, of course, you're like, oh yeah, because that's the most focal part. Like,
it just looks odd. Yeah. But, you know, everyone's got a moment, like some more than others. Like, we get more of Geordi due to his interaction with Data. I mean, Data's always going to be a mainstay in his relationship with Picard. Gates McFadden as Chief Medical Officer, Commander Beverly Crusher. When I think back to this movie, I remember her on the ship at the beginning. Data misinterprets the humor and it pushes her into the water.
Yeah.
Is that her main bit? I mean, she's throughout the movie, but she doesn't really get too much to do.
Yeah. And this is typical for any Star Trek thing. It's not like the OG series where you had a smaller ensemble. Also, you've got to introduce Soren and his storyline. You do have Kirk, and the entire opening, is it 12, 15 minutes of the Enterprise
B? At least 15, maybe even 18 minutes. It's quite a long sequence before you get to the Next Gen crew.
Yeah, so that eats up anything that you could have possibly done with Geordi and Dr. Crusher. Even Deanna. Like, she's, other than noticing something's wrong with Picard and like doing her job and addressing him with it, she gets to do very little. In fact, I did see that she was supposed to have a more sequence at the end when the saucer section's going down, because, you know, she's essentially on the bridge at the time. But pyrotechnics went off, a piece of burning debris fell on the seat as she sat, and she burned her ass.
Oh, what?
Nothing severe.
Oh, I did not know that.
That was supposed to be like one big shot, so they had to re-edit. And so what was probably a character moment for her got removed because they just blew up half the set. They couldn't reshoot that scene. That was supposed to be one long shot. So they used what they could, and then they had to like edit around it and check in on her. And then, you know, she gets her big moment with Picard. She gets a moment at the end with Data when he finds Spot, and then she gets nothing. So, and again, Geordi doesn't really get anything either. He has his initial interactions with Data. Then he gets sidelined for like a large majority, only to come back. And then too much is happening. And he's most of the guy, everyone but Riker and Picard, Cass, and even Worf. Like, shuffled off.
Yeah.
So you end up with just Data, Riker, and Picard because there's just not enough runtime to cover them all.
Well, that's it. Michael Dorn as Lieutenant Commander Worf. I mean, he gets his promotion. It is said that he wouldn't be able to reach the hat when he's on the plank. He jumps up, and then Picard says something along the lines of, over the years, he's learned not to underestimate a Klingon. There's that great gag where, and this is before Picard gets the bad news, there's that great gag where Riker says, computer, remove plank. Worf falls. It is almost like a Wile E. Coyote delayed fall.
Yeah.
I guess it's because he's in the holodeck. And then Picard jumps, you know, he says, that's retract plank or something.
Along those lines. Of course. Yeah. They're having a gap.
So they got them all. That was a good way of getting the next gen cast together. After that long opening with the original cast on the Enterprise B, just getting them all together. But as you say, you know, as soon as you get Sauron, played by Malcolm McDowell, who's bloody fantastic and menacing, you completely buy his motivations. Like, he lost his family and he's going to do whatever it takes to get back to the Nexus, because although not real, what he experienced there of his family being alive, he just wanted to go back and just live in that loop. So you get his motivations. He's going to stop at nothing. But what this movie does, though, what's weird is you find out, so he's the same species as Whoopi Goldberg, her character, Guinan.
Which is an Elorian.
Yeah, but there's a plot point that was not mentioned or was possibly deleted in the final cut, but is mentioned in other media related to this film, such as the comic book adaptation, was that Guinan's brief experience inside the Nexus had changed her, and that she knew things about people, events, and about time in general that she did not know before. This would suggest that her ability for insight on Next Gen is not part of her species, but instead is a gift from the Nexus.
That is super interesting.
Not in the film, but yes.
It's not in the film, yeah. Because we know from Picard that, and there's like a two-parter in the series where they end up back in like old-timey days, and she's there with, wrote Huckleberry Finn, was a like one of the founding father types.
Right, I thought you were doing a Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah, he looks kind of like the Colonel meets Foghorn Leghorn. Right, I think that's actually where Foghorn Leghorn is like based in. Was the author of Huckleberry Finn, who's for some reason name I can't remember right now. But that's the one where they find Data's head, and it's like hundreds of years old. It's like a closed loop where they go back in time. That's where Guinan first meets Picard, and then when you see the Picard series, he first meets her
in the bar, like,
from his perspective in the bar, which is all phenomenal. But it's the whole thing of like, oh, they actually like age super slowly, if not they're immortal.
But it's crazy because we all assumed that her insight was because of her species, but apparently, it's connected to this movie.
Yeah, which is a nice little thing that would be nice to have gotten that in the movie delivered somehow. But Whoopi, great. Malcolm McDowell, I mean, there's nothing you can ever say bad about Malcolm McDowell. He always comes with like passion and like a real presence.
Absolutely. The, but yeah,
the line from this, it's actually from a short poem. Time is the fire in which we burn. He was so taken by it. You know, his character has a gold watch that he's always checking because he's got calculations and stuff. He had that line engraved on that watch because he was like, this is, I like that. That's incredible.
That is cool. But with his character, I just like that. I want to take over the world. Not at all. Do you know what I mean? I like that his motivations are personal.
I'm trying to get
personal.
Back here. And like, I don't think he ever had any intention of giving the devices to the Klingons. He's like, yeah, I'll get down. Here's the thing.
Means
but
to
it
an
won't
end.
Unlock until I said, yeah.
It was
I don't think he ever planned. He's like, yeah, I got what I wanted out of you. And like hell, I'm going to give you anything else. I got what I needed. I don't care what. Come at me. Come get me back out of the ribbon.
Yeah, exactly. You know, decades earlier, McDowell had worked with Patrick Stewart on stage and relished the chance to kill Shatner's character. So there you go. He liked his character's spiked hair and black ensemble. And he did actually request that his character not have alien features to avoid lengthy makeup sessions. So he's like, I'll do your Star Trek film. I want to kill Kirk, and I don't want to sit in that makeup chair any longer than I have to. But he absolutely delivers. When you've got an actor like Patrick Stewart with such gravitas, like it's good for him to have somebody that could be his equal that he's going up against as the film's antagonist. William Shatner, let's do it. Let's talk Kirk. In the film's initial script, the entire principal cast of the original series was featured, but only three members were to appear. Of course, we've got William Shatner, James Doohan as Scott or Scotty, and Walter Koenig as Chekhov. Yeah. Now, they did show a version of Kirk's death to a test audience, and they really didn't like it. So they had to go and redo it. I think it involved him getting shot in the back and they didn't feel as though it was heroic enough. So they went back and changed it. I can imagine Shatner absolutely wanting to be a part of this movie, but not wanting Kirk to die. In fact, do you know what? Years later, he wrote a Star Trek novel and I think it was called The Return. And you find out
that he come back somehow.
Kirk didn't actually die and survive somehow.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Shatner absolutely wanted to be in this movie, but didn't necessarily want to die. And on that, his final two words, this recent rewatch, I had to go back and play it again. He says, oh my.
It's not a Sulu reference. It is
not a
Joyce McCain reference.
It's not. It was a spontaneous ad lib made by Shatner. He later explained this was Kirk's reaction to eternity and truly going where Kirk had never gone before. Oh my.
Yeah, which makes sense of like, oh, I'm not getting out of this. Like this is something serious. This is more serious than I thought. The ending part, the action-y part on the planet there has always bugged me. The set there is very sparse. I imagine because of the difficulty in the filming location.
That does feel like TV. It really does. There's nothing much around. It's just like they're just outside.
Also, the character of Picard has never been like a fisticuffs type. So having a fist fight that he lost twice, essentially.
What is that? He's not a fighter, and he needs Kirk. Like it's Kirk's the brawler. That's what was interesting about when Next Gen was first cast. Jonathan Frakes, Will Riker, is essentially Kirk.
Yeah.
So he does what Kirk would normally do. So
he's a swashbuckler.
Doesn't have to. You know, Shatner has stated that his line, "Who am I to argue with the captain of the Enterprise?" which is a line I've always loved. Because that's when Kirk snaps out of it. This is not reality. I can help you. And he says that line. But for Shatner, he said that it was the hardest line he's ever had to deliver. I guess I get it. You know, he's passing the reins. You know?
Yeah. So I'm the captain of the Enterprise. How dare you make me say such a thing? Interesting side, the ranch where those Kirk scenes were filmed and the horses, all William Shatner's.
All his. And okay, another aside. On horseback, you probably know this, both William Shatner and Patrick Stewart are wearing pantyhoses. Did you know that?
I did not.
William Shatner. And yeah, so they are his horses, or were his horses, and he's been riding for a number of years. And a tip.
Accomplished.
That, yes, accomplished.
Like professionally, like awarded, like in professional competition, like medals and trophies and stuff for whatever they call that thing where you make horses do like set routines and things. Him and his wife.
Well, to make his trousers more comfortable when you're riding the horse, you'd wear a pantyhose.
Yeah, because otherwise they catch on you, so it allows them to swish. William Shatner makes sense.
Went up to Patrick Stewart and said, "I'm wearing a pantyhose. You should wear one too." Patrick Stewart's first thought was, "This is a prank."
Yeah.
But no, it was serious, and apparently, Patrick Stewart was also wearing a pantyhose underneath his uniform.
But also with his experience for those competitions and stuff, and it's like, trust me, you're gonna thank me. Not only will it look better on camera, you'll be more comfortable. And Patrick Stewart, from all his Shakespeare, no stranger to pantyhose.
Well, that's it. But it's interesting what you said about Shatner and the horse, because it adds so much to it. You can see that it is him on that horse. So not only does it lead to them getting those fantastic close-ups from different directions when he's making that same jump over and over, and that's one of the moments that he realizes that he's made. I mean, how many times he says he's made that jump over the years? And he was afraid every time, except for this time, because he knows that the Nexus
doesn't allow him to have those negative emotions of like, it's a thrill, but I could have died. It all comes together.
So we've mentioned the other original cast members, James Doohan as Scotty. Having him there adds so much. And again, I know they tried to get other cast members as well who did decline. Leonard Nimoy, Nichelle Nichols, George Takei, they all turned it down for different reasons. And, you know, they all had their own reasons. And, you know, instead of getting Sulu, we got his daughter, you know, which was very clever.
George Takei's makes the most sense, which is Sulu's the captain. To take that role would be a demotion for him. I don't like that character arc for him. I'm not accepting for behalf of the character. I'm like, that is very, very admirable that you're like, I won't take that payday because I don't like what that implies for the character.
He's very protective over Sulu, what Sulu has achieved. Like, he was a captain in the undiscovered countries. I get it.
Yeah. They tried to get DeForest Kelly, but he was in seriously poor health at the time and couldn't pass a medical, be allowed on set, which is a requirement for insurance purposes and I think the Actors Guild, it's like a ruling for. So he wanted to be there, which is why it's Chekhov, like, you two, you've just become medical officers. Like, you know, I do love that line of like, tractor beam is going to be installed on Tuesday. The rest of the thing, Tuesday. Proton torpedoes, let me guess. Tuesday,
yeah. That's a good point, actually. Yeah, they pretty much shared out the dialogue, didn't they?
Yeah, so, yeah, Chekhov, that was supposed to be Bones. It was like, you two just became doctors. The reason why Leonard Nimoy was approached to direct first and be in it, and he turned it down. He turned down the Spock acting because he said these lines are so planned they could have been spoken by anyone. And proven right by the fact the opening of the movie, as we see it, although I imagine there's some small tweaks. Why he didn't direct, I don't know. Maybe he had something else in other coals in the fire at the time, or maybe he just wanted to get away from Star Trek, or maybe, I don't know. But he turned down directing, which is why they ended up with Dave Carson. I don't know about Nichelle Nichols. I don't know why she would have turned it down. I didn't find anything in my research for that one.
Yeah, but I do know.
Again, there's not a lot of fat for him to chew on. Like, no, maybe it was like, I don't want to be there for.
And it's the first,
what's the point?
It's the first, what would you say, 15, 18 minutes thereabouts. But the next gen cast were excited. They didn't know that all of the available original series cast members weren't going to be involved, especially Whoopi Goldberg. Like, she went to work thinking she was going to be with Nichelle Nichols, and obviously it wasn't.
Yeah, her hero, yeah.
It wasn't meant to be. But that opening, we've got Alan Ruck as
such Enterprise B. Such a great actor.
Yeah, Enterprise B Captain John Harriman. And, you know, I'd always taken him as, like, he's not fit for command. Like, he shouldn't be there. Like, he's looking to others for answers where your captain should be leading. But what was interesting when I was looking up just bits about his character, when approached for the role, Ruck assumed he would play an alien saying, look, when I shave every day, I don't look in the mirror and say, hey, there's a starship commander. But he was informed that the character was from a wealthy and connected family and was placed in command as a stepping stone to a political career. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. But you know what we're talking about before with Guinan and how she's got her abilities connected to the Nexus and the backstory for John Harriman makes it better, but it's not in the film.
Yeah, it does.
It's like, oh, that's also really like, interesting.
It makes sense. It's like, this was supposed to be just a simple shakedown thing for the press. I'm not prepared. I don't have the people and resources. Everything else is coming Tuesday. I don't have enough people. I have zero experience, essentially, in this, with this ship at least, and this crew. It all feeds. That backstory makes even more sense than just my assumption of, like, he's a young captain being put in charge of the Enterprise in front of the press with the original crew standing, like, over his shoulder, essentially. Like, a lot of people would have been shaken by that responsibility, but.
But this guy, though, stepping stone to a political career. So there we go. Yeah. But great casting, though. Alan Ruck.
Phenomenal casting.
Now people think Succession. Then people thought Cameron, Ferris Bueller's Day.
Yeah.
Which also, I believe
someone,
was an issue.
A son of a wealthy.
Cameron was. But for the longest time, like, he was just getting hired to play parts like Cameron. And obviously he had more range than that. Okay. You know, thinking about it, 1994, this is the same year that he did Speed. He was one of the passengers on the bus.
Yeah, he was, yeah. And following this, he worked for James Cameron on Dark Angel. He was the guy who ran the stuck up boss who ran the where they worked, which was a bike courier company.
Interesting. Jessica Alba.
Was he also in Spin City? Was he in Spin City?
I think he was. Yeah. Yeah,
he was like the smarmy, slimy
That's
guy.
It.
In the office.
Oh man, Spin City. First with Michael J. Fox, then with Charles Sheen. Yeah, I remember watching Spin City. But okay, back to Star Trek. I always find it distracting seeing Tim Russ, not a Vulcan, completely different character.
Yeah, before Voyager, this was at Voyager. I don't think Voyager started its first season yet. Because there was two seasons of DS9, and then it was once they disassembled the sets for Next Gen that they repurposed those sound stages for Voyager. So I don't think he'd been cast yet.
Yeah, this
got cast for this.
It'd make no sense. for him to be doing Voyager and then just play a human on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Yeah. It's like, why would you do that? Although Patrick Stewart, oh no, he'd already been cast. Obviously, that's something in the book. He'd already been cast as Picard, and they put him as a Klingon in the Undiscovered Country because under all that makeup, he was not as recognizable.
Hang on.
Because he was a bold Klingon in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
What?
Yep.
No way.
Yep. Yeah.
Bullshit.
I've always preferred Hamlet in its traditional Klingon. Line delivered.
No.
By Patrick Stewart, dressed as a Klingon.
No way.
Yep.
You just blow my mind. I would have known that if we'd done an episode about Undiscovered Country. We will get to it one day.
Yeah.
Wow. Yep. I did not know that. I mean, Star Trek really do recycle sets, explosions.
And actors.
Actors.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think the record for most appearances as different characters is Jeffrey Combs, Star Trek. He's been I think he's been like every race bar a Klingon and Borg. I think he's practically played everything else.
Yeah, wow. Honestly, I'm still stuck on what you told me about Patrick Stewart in Star Trek VI.
Yeah. Speaking Klingons, we do have the return of they're not the Lursa sisters. It's Lursa and Beator. The Klingon sisters who were dastardly, I'll use that phrase. I think it was season 5 or season 6 in Next Gen, they were a common thorn for specifically Worf. They were trying to usurp power in the Klingon Empire, and Worf was on a hiatus, doing an exchange because his brother showed up, and he was on Konos, taking care of that stuff, and it was the sisters, thing that came up, and that's why they've got this ongoing the Enterprise and those guys there ruined all our stuff. But they don't make it out of this. They are still big draws at Star Trek conventions.
Oh, really?
And they from DS9, there's Galron, the head of the Klingon Empire, and General Martok. They show up in full costume. They actually do a comedy duo in full costume.
Oh, that's cool.
At Star Trek conventions, they do something similar where a lot of the time they'll show up in full costume and makeup as the sisters and meet the fans and do all that stuff. And to this day, big draws at conventions. It's roles that they've played multiple years on Next Gen. So it's them in this role. Makes sense for, you want someone familiar. How's Sauron getting around? Oh, he hired them. We already know that they're
from the sounds of it,
the Enterprise.
The fan favorites, actors that are fully embraced the roles. So it makes sense that if you're going to have Klingons, you're going to bring them back, even if it is just for one last time for obvious reasons.
Yeah, and they do get the distinction of having destroyed the Enterprise D.
Yeah, there you go. And that was a crazy thing to see in itself, because they can't destroy the ship on the TV series because they need it next week because it's a TV show. Whereas this was the start of just destroying the Enterprise. We'll get it for another film. The following film, destroy the Enterprise.
It's a trope.
But we see it here first time. Okay, costumes. Let's get into it. A new set of Starfleet uniforms was intended to be introduced in this film to be worn by the Enterprise D crew. These new uniforms would have been similar to the TV ones, except the collars would have been the same department color as the rest of the tunic, and the rank pips would have been worn on the shoulder with a corresponding rank parade on the wrists. The uniforms were eventually nixed by producer Rick Berman, so they went in a different direction. But, you know, they were playing around with some ideas. The decision was then made to use the uniforms from The Next Generation, as well as the uniforms from Deep Space Nine. However, Playmates had already made an action figure line for the film with the Enterprise D crew wearing the aborted uniforms. It was too late to retract the figures, which is the only place the aborted uniforms can be seen. So I've seen them toys, and they do. They've got the. So
I was very aware. I was very aware of that one.
The wrists. But okay, yep. So I've said it. It's always been a massive point of distraction for me watching this movie.
You're not the only one. A lot of Star Trek fans are like, whoa, 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 whoa. Militaries do not move through uniforms.
But it's happening
frequently. It's a gag. It's a gag in Lower Decks of like, they're on, it's the same
timeline. It's a gag because it happened here. That's why it's a gag on Lower Decks.
It happens all the time because, it's a movie. We need to change it up. Like even Discovery season 1 and 2 have the uniforms they have. Then instead of just keeping those uniforms, they actually do make a line. Oh, they're in the new uniforms when Pike shows up at the start of season 2. But then the first season of Strange New Worlds, they've got a tweaked, altered version of that, which is like halfway between what they had done and the weird offset collars, which didn't look quite right, and what they had in the original series. And then you go from the original series to the movies, and they had those like was it green or blue with the white triangle thing? And then the next movie, and for the rest of the movies, they had, well, the original cast is wearing this, the beautiful red,
yes,
with white and the shoulder strap, which I still love. It's still one of my favorite costumes. But and then it's not until Next Gen that they changed, which they tweaked bit, like season by season until they got to something they liked.
Wasn't it? It was like Lycra. Like when they're like
which
cyclists.
Was terrible for the actors back because because it's so tight, it wouldn't show wrinkles. But it was terrible for the actors' posture and joints and like for long days of filming, it was torturous. So you had to keep tweaking it to make it comfortable and look somewhat like they did, which is why we get the Picard maneuver of him fixing his jacket whenever he stands up.
Yeah, that's it.
And then they tweak, they tweak it all the time. But it is that thing of like every time there's a new Star Trek show, even if it's just a new season, they have different costumes. Again, you're like, they don't change uniforms that frequently.
I know. Between seasons, whatever. Okay, I can go with that. In the space of a movie, characters are wearing different versions of either got the classic, you know, colours across the chest.
Yeah, like Picard goes from his Next Gen one to the DS9 one back to the... It goes back again. But Riker's wearing the DS9 one.
But characters that don't get as much screen time as Deanna Troi, she's wearing the classic Next Gen. Okay, so I've got some more information, right, which... If you don't know this, like this really like surprised me, but it kind of makes sense. Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner were the only cast members to have custom color top uniforms as used in seasons 1 through 5 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and later on in Star Trek Voyager. Get this, right? Jonathan Frakes had to borrow Avery Brooks's uniform and Levar Burton had to borrow Cole Meany's uniform from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, neither of which fit very well. Frakes had to roll up the sleeves and Burton's is obviously too large for him. They're wearing other actors' wardrobe.
I did know this. I didn't that know is... that they used like the hero cast. I thought they would have been like backstage actors. Extras of these are barely used. It's like, no, these are the ones that get used like every day on set.
You're wondering how they managed to make this movie in 1994 for $35 million. This is another example of how they achieved it. They went
how
and
the
raided,
sandwich is made.
They went and raided the wardrobe department of a TV series. Deep Space Nine.
Just a mishmash of everyone's costumes.
What's making this movie? But it's always been a big distraction for me. And every time I watch it,
they sort people on the same ship using different uniforms.
It makes no sense. But do you know what? First Contact, We'll get to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Better uniforms. I love those uniforms. I really,
yeah.
I really do.
I will say, I think we brought it up during Picard season 3, but I'm going to say it again. Enterprise D, my favorite Enterprise. And the fact that they destroyed it, I was actually, this is one of my notes because it still bugs me. Why did they destroy the Enterprise D? Like, oh, the warp core's overloading. Oh, eject it. I don't know how many times in movies and TV episodes of TV, and they've actually, we've seen them do it on multiple occasions. Just eject it. And I searched, I'm like, there's got to be an in-universe reason why. And all of it was producers hated that model. Pain in the ass to work with. It was too big. It was too heavy. They didn't like the design. It didn't look good on the big screen. They wanted a redesigned Enterprise.
And that, well, again,
so that's the abs. That's the behind the scenes reason.
And it looks just, great on TV.
I think it looks. I think it's a beautifully designed ship. It's always been my favorite.
Do you know how big it is?
It's a six-foot model.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is. It's a 6 foot, two-part model.
And they have the a smaller four-foot one for more complicated maneuvering shots.
Yes.
And one, if they want to use it.
But the one in this movie, the six-foot one, it's the one that they used in 87 for Encounter at Farpoint. And it was taken out of storage, refurbished to meet the demands of the big screen.
Yeah, it still looks amazing. I still love it.
It does. And then they destroyed it. And we get a new Enterprise in the next film. You know, apparently...
Which still looks great. Which still looks amazing.
Yes,
but
it does. It's... But apparently... The Enterprise's saucer was meant to break in half during the crash sequence, which would have been the main reason why Starfleet could not take the saucer and attach this to a new engineering hull. However, this was quickly determined that there would be no way to satisfactorily achieve the effect with models or CGI of that era, and the idea was abandoned. So it ends up getting destroyed the way that it does in the movie. But then we find out in the TV show Picard that the saucer section of the Enterprise D was recovered and restored at the Starfleet Museum, citing the Prime Directive. So that's pretty, pretty cool. And that's how we get it in season 3 of Picard. That's how we get to see it.
And thank God they did, because I even love that. Like, it's like, why you got so many of the D? Like, oh, no one likes the fat one. And it's like, oh, how dare you, sir?
Yeah. Although I do love the... I had a model, like, when First Contact first came out of, like...
The E is
Enterprise
beautiful.
E. It is really, very slick. It is, but this is classic, though. It really is a classic design. I was, like, thinking of the opening title sequence of the TV show. It's, like, constantly just whooshing past the screen.
Yeah.
But all, I just see it get over and over. You know, my... I guess my assumption... It's been a while since I watched Generations, is that the score was composed by Jerry Goldsmith. It was not. It was composed by Dennis McCarthy.
Yep.
He's a guy whose soundtrack credits include several entries in the Star Trek franchise, including underscores for Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, and of course this movie. And his other TV credits include Dynasty, V, MacGyver, Sliders, Dawson's Creek. He's done a lot of this. He's done a lot of TV and this film. But what I did find, though, he also produced the album Old Yellow Eyes Is Back by Brent Spiner and composed music for stage productions. So that was a play on Frank Sinatra, Old Blue Eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, Data. On the album, Spiner is backed by the orchestra from Star Trek as he sings a number of old pop standards, mostly from the 30s and 40s. I never even knew this was a thing. I'm after going.
Neither did I.
So that is the composer of Star Trek Generations working with Brent Spiner. They've got an album.
That's incredible.
worth checking out.
I'm definitely going to check that out.
I am too. But in the meantime, if you're going to rate Star Trek Generations out of 5.
I'm going to come in at a 4 out of 5. It isn't the best Star Trek film. It's not the best Next Gen film. but it's not the worst next-gen film. Specifically on this watch, the stuff with Picard and the loss he suffered, which we didn't even talk about, how him dealing with his emotions there and his neglect earlier on in the film helps him counsel and Data when he's in the Astro Lab, and he's like, no, like, you do your job and you work through these things. That's what it means. And then he softens because it's echoing kind of what he's going through. A very natural integration of the A and B story. Yes, it does feel like somewhat of a bloated episode from the series, but I love the series, so that's never been an issue for me. The only real weakness other than the costumes not all lining up with all the cast is the underwhelming fisticuffs on the planet at the end. It's never sat right with me. It's does come across a little underwhelming, but again, all three of these, like, Kirk's the only one who's an actual brawler. And you can't have him win. Otherwise your tension for those shots go. But otherwise everyone's, you know, they were at the height of their abilities. They've been playing these characters for 7 years. It does look great for the big screen. I do like that this, the fact that they still had models, even though it was the last time around. But yeah, I do enjoy it. Slightly flawed, but not enough to degrade my enjoyment. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm also going to come in at a 4 out of 5 on this one. I like this film a lot. I really do. When you get to the scenes between Picard and Kirk, I love it. I love everything about it. It works so well. It's a good next gen movie. It was a clever way of bringing the old and the new actors together. Apparently, it's something that Gene Roddenberry never wanted to happen. And after his passing, they brought the characters together. But for me, it works. And we'd had it before in the next gen TV series, like Encounter at Farpoint. DeForest Kelly was in it as Bones, Elderly. That two-parter with Leonard Nimoy and Spock as Spock. So we've had it before.
Yeah, that was I don't remember what they call it.
I'm blanking on the name.
Yeah, Reconciliation.
But that was really good.
But it also was a two-parter with Scotty, who'd been in the transporter loop, and they crashed on that Dyson sphere.
There we go.
Half the cast had already been next.
They'd done it already. But I like this film a lot, and my enjoyment is probably more than the quality of the overall film. Like, I know if you're not a Star Trek fan, maybe you're not going to enjoy it as much. But for me, I've always really enjoyed watching this film. And you're right, the third act and the brawl outside, it's a bit anticlimactic, but it does work overall because you've got all the cast coming back. And I like it. I like it a lot. I'm going to come in at a 4 out of 5. Was that Super Rat episode all about Star Trek Generations?
If you'd like to contact us about this episode or suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, you can find us on Facebook as Sounds Like Comics Podcast.
You've been listening to Luke and Jay, the guys from Sounds Like Comics. See you soon.